Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Mags, bringing you 30 minutes packed with the latest South African and global news. We're live right now and you can catch us later as a podcast. Stay tuned for interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers and leading experts, delivering all the essential updates you need, fast and focused. It's Thursday, the 29th of August. Coming up on the program, new technical efforts underway to improve flight delays. New research on the value of the digital economy. There is concern over the new Electricity Regulation Amendment Act and the narrowing gender split when it comes to loyalty programs. We have all experienced the frustration of flight disruption, and some of it has to do, I understand, with outdated instrument flight procedures, which are expected to ease soon. This is according to Air Traffic and Navigation Services, which is now undertaking a process to find the cause of the problem and obviously provide a solution. And this particular issue has also drawn the attention of the Transport Minister, Barbara Creasy, who joins me on the program now. Minister, welcome to you. And what's the root cause here? What are we actually referring to?
Good afternoon, Jeremy, and greetings to all your listeners. Well, my understanding from the work that I've been doing with the Air Traffic Navigation Services is that the current CEO inherited a situation where for many years air traffic flight procedures had not been updated. I believe that there are over 300 of these procedures. And from the perspective of the public, while they are important because they are procedures that ensure safe landing, safe takeoff of aircraft, and of course, safe journey during the flight. And what has to happen is that these procedures have to be reviewed by the Air Traffic Navigation Service, and they have to be submitted to the Civil Aviation Authority, who would then assess whether they meet international safety standards and who would then suggest if further work needs to be done or if these are acceptable.
Now, Minister, you're new in the position and your job obviously is not to look into the rearview mirror, but it is extraordinary, is it not, that an issue as important as this was not dealt with earlier and more timeously?
Yes, I think that that is definitely the case. And this is why I have advised the Air Traffic Navigation Services that as we deal with the immediate issues that are impacting on passengers at the moment, let's also open the cupboards, clean them, give them a good clean, and make sure that the house is fully in order from the root of the problem.
The concern here, of course, is the old safety versus speed argument, and critical that the service ensures safety while, I imagine, urgently restoring procedures. Again, you're not intimately involved in this, but you'll agree that that is the overarching process or protocol that needs to be adhered to.
Absolutely, Jeremy. And in the meetings that I've had with relevant regulatory authorities, I have made it absolutely clear that we must not and cannot cut corners when it comes to safety. And I'm sure that frustrating as it is, and, you know, I fly at least 2, 3, 4 times a week, so I personally have experienced the frustrations. Frustrating as it is, We know that our country has a good record of air safety, and I'm sure the public would be in agreement that we need to maintain that record, even if there's short-term discomfort.
But an issue like this, Minister, also has a domino or a knock-on impact, does it not? I have spoken to people who have wanted to invest money in this country, for instance, and at some point in the conversation, it's come up about why are our flights always delayed? So it has that knock-on effect, does it not? And it's got to be resolved quickly.
Indeed. And I have had meetings with the airline industry and also with AXA, and they've explained to me that this affects current business. It has the potential to affect market share, and it's definitely not the kind of reputation we want in the international or domestic space.
What assurances then are you getting from ATNS on the update and the full restoration of flight procedures?
Well, I have asked them to submit a comprehensive plan to me to deal with all 300 procedures. I have asked them to estimate how long that will take. I have also asked them to tell me if there are additional warm bodies or additional resources required. And I'm expecting to receive that plan within the next 10 days. Obviously, there would be what the service calls priority procedures. There are about 80 of those. And those procedures would affect runway 21 at OR Tambo International, as well as other runways throughout the country. And some of these procedures, in fact, the vast majority of them have already been submitted to the Civil Aviation Authority for consideration. And clearly, the Civil Aviation Authority requires its own time to consider these and to make sure that everything is fully compliant with safety standards.
And just finally, to fix 300 procedures sounds very expensive.
Well, what I'm told is that because we are opening the cupboards, there are things at the back of the cupboard that we don't need anymore. So that is part of what will be in the plan, is which of these procedures can be scrapped and which ones need to be updated. And I'm looking forward to receiving that plan.
As are we to reading it. Transport Minister Barbara Creasy, thank you very much.
Thank you, Jeremy.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, new research from NASPERS and the Mapungubwe Institute of Strategic Reflection is showing digital platforms, and wait for this number, could add 91.4 billion rand into South Africa's economy by 2035. The research reveals that the digital platform economy could be a real game changer for the country. I'm going to talk now to Mashete Rakabe, who's a senior researcher in political economy at the Institute. And firstly, then, if we've got so much money potentially coming into the economy, how is it going to happen?
Well, it's going to happen through accelerating the pace of the digital transformation, and that's the reason why we actually undertook this this research. It was really to conscientize South Africa about the changing nature of economic activity and how we are likely to be left behind if we don't keep pace with the rest of the global economy. So, and for that, we used of course NASPERS lenses just to look at how we could possibly fast track that kind of a transformation. And we are thinking that one way of doing this is, of course, calling for that transformation from government, private sector, the civil society, just to join hands together and really start trying to understand what it means for South Africa to really keep up with the pace of transformation. Secondly, it's about investing in the skills that are required for us to transition into this global digital economy, especially by investing in the STEM skills. So we're currently sitting at 18%, and we think that if we increase that to 30%, that should at least get us closer to that target of 91 billion. And the other thing is really the impact of infrastructure, that we think infrastructure is a key enabler of digital transformation, especially because we're looking at the digital platforms in this case. So we think that if we keep a concerted focus on improving infrastructure, particularly the physical one, electricity, logistics, because those are enablers of digital platform businesses, that is also going to help. But more importantly, providing people with digital ID so that they can be able to participate in the digital economy. And lastly, is just to make sure that we drive an inclusive digital platforms economy. So just making sure that some of the underlying drivers of the digital platforms, which are most likely to be your small scale manufacturers, are integrated into some of the platforms so that we can be able to sell some of the globally competitive products to the rest of the other international markets.
So you've certainly outlined the potential as far as this is concerned, but the interesting issue or the conundrum, I suppose, is why we are lagging in digital transformation compared to other countries. Is it a question of strategy, policy, or money, or a combination of all three?
Well, it's a combination of all three. And I suppose one of the biggest issues with South Africa and Africa is that we still very much concerned with the immediate needs. And sometimes we think that this transformation is something that is going to happen in the distant future. And so we're taking time to really try to adapt, because, of course, we're trying to address the immediate needs. So at a policy level, we actually think that's one of the key constraints in two ways, that you need to start regulating these digital platforms as they come on board, but also be alive to the pace of the transformation of this digital platform, so that you don't stifle innovation in the process. So you regulate, but also be flexible in the sense of enabling people or startups to innovate, and that's how you actually going to catch up. Money wise, it's not really a matter of finance, really, because what we find is actually a lot of funding that is available for tech startups in Africa and South Africa specifically. So there isn't really that hurdle of money. It's just a matter of enabling innovation, enabling, providing the space for the innovators to innovate and support those innovators. And I suppose even from a public sector perspective, is that this need to, for this adoption of this new innovation, so that it's not just a matter of creating policy, developing policy and leaving it there, but also leading the way in terms of digital adoption, adapting in digital platforms in public services such as healthcare, education, home affairs, all of those. So those are some of the things that we see as policy areas that can really unlock the growth of the transformation.
In the short term, and I mean the very short term, are there specific actions that business and government should be taking collaboratively to drive digital growth?
In the short term, what we are saying is that we need this collaboration, firstly, to be clear about what digital transformation means for South Africa. So where are we going with this digital transformation? In other words, how much of a role do you want to play in the fintech space? How much of a role do you want to play in the education tech spaces? How much of a role do you want to play in the different platforms, market segments? Once we are clear about that role, then you can start investing or prioritizing areas which will need immediate attention. In our case, we think that e-commerce is actually one of the key ones that has been driven by private sector in the main. So we think those are the key areas, the low-hanging fruits that government can actually do. But even more importantly, the skills one that we are mentioning about increasing 18% STEM graduates from 18 to 30%, we think already there are instruments like your National Student Financial Aid Scheme that can be used to channel students away from all these other generic studies into this STEM, but at the same time, making sure that you also improve the foundational phase so that the students or who come from the basic education system can easily be absorbed into some of this STEM study fields.
Thank you very much indeed from the Mapungubwe Institute for Strategic Reflection. Mashete Rakabe, thank you indeed. I do appreciate your time today.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Attention, all investors and finance enthusiasts. Get ready for the annual Money Summit, Africa's largest and most influential savings and investment event. Join me, Jeremy Maggs, on Tuesday, the 10th of September at the Sandton Convention Center as we connect with over 100 top chief executives and industry leaders across 20 exciting conferences and forums, all in one incredible day. Secure your spot now. Register online at www.moneysummit.co.za for free with the code MoneyWebGuest. This is your chance to be part of Africa's premier savings and investment event. Don't miss it.
MoneyWeb at Midday for all your up-to-date stories.
My next guest writes that South Africa endured an electricity crisis from 2008, characterized by intermittent rolling blackouts and a growing culture of non-payment. But now we have the Electricity Regulation Amendment Act, and it's the beginning of the end for Eskom, according to some observers. Well, Rod Crompton is visiting adjunct professor, African Energy Leadership Center at the Wits Business School, and he joins me on the program now. And first of all, Professor, what specific risks does the act introduce?
Well, it's a new act which the president has assented to, but he hasn't yet brought it into operation. And we know from precedent, for example, in the National Energy Act, where certain clauses were brought into operation and others weren't. And already there's some talk about that. So, for example, the South African Local Government Association has objected to certain provisions, the definition, for example, around reticulation. And you'll know reticulation is one of the words that occurs in Schedule 4B to the Constitution. So they have threatened legal action, and President Ramaphosa has left the door open to exclude certain provisions. Now, unfortunately, those provisions sort of underpin the rest of the Act. So if they are left out, I'm not sure how the Act can be implemented. Maybe other parts can still be implemented.
Is the suggestion here that it was signed too early?
No. People have said that this amendment to the definition of reticulation was a bit of an 11th hour amendment during the parliamentary process. But I'm not that close to it personally, so I can't verify that or say that's happened for sure. But clearly there's some unhappiness in Salga. And so there could be a legal challenge. I think there are other areas which are of concern, and that is ministerial discretion. So, you know, as we move increasingly to private ownership in the electricity sector, investor confidence becomes more important. And wide-ranging ministerial discretion contributes to investor uncertainty.
How important, Professor, is this act to energy security in South Africa?
Well, we've had a long and bumpy road since 1998, 26 years ago, when this electricity market reform appeared in the white paper on energy policy. And now we are at the threshold. This act represents a substantial reform, and we are at the threshold of it, and we are anxiously waiting to see if this act is actually going to be implemented or not. But it's a very big step and very important step because it will introduce competition in various parts of the electricity market and will allow increasing private sector involvement and will, you know, as that happens, hopefully relieve taxpayers of the burden of bailing out Eskom as they've had to do over the last decade or so.
But having said that, though, you also raise concern about transmission infrastructure and particularly bottlenecking for new market entrants.
Yes, the Act provides for what they call third-party access. So this is a lesser form of access. Well, first of all, let me say access is absolutely important for generators to be able to transport their electricity to their customers. So they need access to the wires, to the transmission and distribution networks. And the mechanism there is third-party access, which is different, for example, from SANRAL's toll roads and from the Petroleum Pipelines Act, which talks about a much better form of access, so what we call common carriage, where all users are treated equally. But in this case, third-party access tends to protect the incumbents like Eskom and the municipalities, because it's the first party is the owner of the infrastructure, the second party is their customers, and then third-party access is for whatever capacity is left over. And the Act makes it clear that access can be refused if there's a lack of capacity. So it's not quite an open market. It's definitely a step in the right direction, but it's not full access.
You would also have concern, if I read this correctly, about the duration of the licenses.
Yes, so electricity infrastructure can be long-term investment. So the power stations that Eskom is building have a 50-year lifespan, typically. But the licenses in this new act are for 20 years. So an investor who builds some long-term infrastructure, and it could be transmission wires, which also have a long lifespan, certainly more than 20 years. If they invest with a license that ends in 20 years, even though it could be renewed, that's a risk they don't want to take. So they will want to recover all of the investment over the first 20 years instead of spreading it over the useful life of the asset, which, for example, could be 50 years. So you get what we call intergenerational inequity. So this generation is going to be paying for these assets, but the future generation, that is to say those who come after the 20-year period, are going to get something of a, in inverted commas, free ride. Not that it'll be free, but they won't be paying for this infrastructure, which has already been paid for in the first 20 years.
And that's likely to put off entrants, surely?
Well, no, I don't think investors would prefer it, because they'll get their money back quicker. But customers might not be so happy.
And finally, if I could just ask you, you also raise the issue about Eskom's current debt load. And so even if we have this new legislation in place, that's always going to be an overarching problem, is it not?
Indeed it is. I mean, the money has been spent and it has to be paid back by somebody. So at the moment, you know, what's been happening over the last decade or so is that taxpayers have been bailing out Eskom, and it's been using that money to pay off some of its debt and some of it for its operating costs and so on. So that has to be resolved somehow. But what's looming in the future, which I didn't cover in the article, is that these big, giant coal-fired power stations, because Medupi and Kusile were, you know, over time and over budget, very, very expensive, are they going to be competitive in a market? And will we not be, as a society, confronted with stranded assets at some point down the line, which I think is likely, both renewables and coal-fired stranded assets? And how is society going to deal with that problem is something that's awaiting us down the road.
Professor Rod Crompton, thank you very much, as always, for talking to me.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
According to new research from Truth and Brand Map, for the very first time, both male and female South African consumers are equally engaged in loyalty programs, with a 76% participation from each gender. With me now is Amanda Cromhote, Chief Executive Officer of Truth. And Amanda, first of all then, what factors have led to this equal participation?
It is for the first time that we see absolute equality between the two genders with their usage of loyalty programs. Yes. So we've been tracking it since 2015 and the gap has been narrowing, but now is the first time it's exactly the same. Yep.
And is there a specific factor driving that?
So, Jeremy, we believe the factor is from COVID, actually. So we saw the shift more prominent when we did the report, the Truth and Brand Map Loyalty White Paper in 2022. For the first time, we saw just one percentage point difference between the two. So male usage was 73%, female usage 74% of female South Africans using loyalty programs. And that gap was the first time it was so close. And if you think about consumer behavior during COVID, people working from home, probably more shared activities, buying the groceries. Oh, wow, look, you get points back when you go to the supermarket or you go to Clicks and so forth. So the realization, I think, that normally the female in the household would take on more of those activities, suddenly the shift came through. We saw it prominently in the 2022 report.
So it's neck and neck now. What do we read into that? Why is that important? And what does it mean, Amanda, for loyalty programs themselves?
So it basically means that the program managers, the practitioners, the brands that we all use need to understand in a little bit more granular detail. So the headline of 76% of South Africans use loyalty programs, which doesn't change across genders, is interesting that males have caught up. But you can't really change too much of your strategy because of that. What we need to do is look at, well, what about that that makes it more interesting? So if you think about how to design a loyalty program, there's a number of lots and lots of ideas that you could use to make your program attractive. So we would probably in the past look at more retail. So you can see the sectors where females do still dominate more. So all customers like cashback, whether it's cash directly or points. But the sectors that are different between the genders is where we need to start to unpack it more, and then the actual benefits that consumers want. So the different sectors you see where, remembering that everybody still always wants cash at the top of the pile, but the sectors where men are more likely to get higher usage of loyalty programs than female are in hotels and banking for the more affluent South Africans, and females will be still dominating in restaurants and retail, whether that's clothing, grocery or pharmaceutical. For the less wealthy South Africans, so that's 10,000 household income or less, it's fuel and banking. So you'll see that males dominate. So you'll see that banking still dominates across both, whether they're wealthier or not. But there's a hotel travel versus fuel, less glamorous travel, I guess, for the less wealthy. But retail continues for female. And then, as I said, we unpack in the white paper the benefits that consumers want. And that shows some difference between male and female. And that's what practitioners have got to understand, because their customers are bespoke to their brand, bespoke to their industry, and they need to organize and design their program accordingly. So, you know, females, for example, so male, where it's probably easier to say, where do males differ? And again, remembering they all want cash, but the males are more likely to get excited about airtime and data, more excited about airport lounge access, and that would correlate if there's a business travel element that a male is potentially doing more of. And then a little bit of the digitization of loyalty programs. And interestingly, overall, a status play. So this is actually a super important point. Females, bit more down to earth, bit more how much cash am I going to get back into my household to pay for the bills this month, pay for my groceries. Males, a little bit more, and I can say this maybe as a female, but the male response is a little bit more, well, actually, I quite like these status things like tiers and lounge access and stuff that makes me feel good. And I always joke when I board an aircraft, if you look at women putting their bags in the overhead lockets, unlikely to have a gold bag tag on, but trust me, if a guy's got a gold status, it'll be on his bag.
I'm flying at the weekend, and I'm going to do exactly that when I get onto the aeroplane. Amanda, put on your psychologist's hat if you can, and I'm going to choose the way in which I phrase this next question very carefully. Men prefer immediate rewards. They want instant gratification, don't they?
So we see across the board both instant gratification and building up your points. And what's interesting is the most invested customers in loyalty programs, so those customers that love loyalty the most, actually like to do both, you know, and that they're not mutually exclusive. So that's super important. But in terms of the male-female split, you will see definitely the male having a little less patience, I guess, about, well, when will my points build up for something worthwhile? Again, going back to the psychology of like the mum looking after the family or looking after the household budget, she's prepared to wait a little bit because she can see next month she can maybe get R100 off or vouchers off back to school benefits or whatever the deal is. Whereas, you know, if I even just look at my family or people I know, the male response to loyalty programs is very much more, how do I get that benefit? How does it make me feel good immediately? And how do I get the status? So, yeah.
And fundamentally, as we look to the future, all of this, I imagine, will come down to personalization. And a loyalty program is going to work better if there is a one-on-one relationship. Not all programs or brands get that.
Absolutely. And Jeremy, that point is probably the most significant in the sense that giving away generic offers is interesting and it's nice and it's almost the ticket to the game for these brands. But the winners of these programs are the winners in the industries are the programs that are offering personalized deals or personalized experiences. So whether it's your grocery store, whether it's your bank, whether it's a travel experience, we are not the same, even though demographically customer groupings are the same. They actually, their data they give you through loyalty programs show what they really want from you. And the brands that are getting it right are the brands we're seeing, A, in the South African white paper that we released with Brandmap, and B, in the South African Loyalty Awards, actually, that gets announced in 2 weeks. The brands doing personalization are the brands that are getting recognized.
And how do they get that right? Is it just better or more adept interpretation of the data?
Principally, yes. Principally, but obviously you've got to do that with permission from your customer. So you need to build up trust with your customer because customers don't readily give their data away unless they trust it's going to be used ethically and responsibly. And I think the data legislation is good for consumer, good for brands, and has changed the game considerably. I do argue that the South African loyalty market is one of the most advanced in the world in terms of number of programs, number of good programs on offer for consumers. But I feel where we need to improve is that not digitization, but the seamless execution of brilliant personalization. So that it really feels at every touch point that this brand understands me because of the data they've collected.
All right, I'm going to leave it there. I've got some points that I need to go and redeem. Amanda Cromhurt, thank you very much indeed. And just before I bid you farewell, on our last online poll, I spoke about a survey in which 50% of women in middle management roles believe they will not achieve their career goals. I asked if that sounded right, if it might be more, or if the number was exaggerated. And most of our listeners think that assessment is spot on. And today, following the interview with the Minister of Transport about outdated instrument flight procedures, my question to you today is, how often are you experiencing flight delays? Not a lot or more than usual? If you have a view on that, please go to either our X or LinkedIn page. And that is our program for today. MoneyWeb at Midday is live at noon weekdays. We are then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.